Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Chicago-based jazz trumpeter, composer, bandleader, and educator Ella Grace. We get into her debut 2026 album, Figments, and a rise in the world of jazz. Out on Shifting Paradigm, the record has seven original contemporary jazz compositions and is brought to life by some of Chicago's most compelling young musicians. Drummer Jaden Richardson, bassist Marianne Millard, pianist Deval Stanley, saxophonist Garrett Muntz, and vocalist Julia Danielle. She came up in the Twin Cities jazz scene before relocating to Chicago in 2021 to pursue a degree in jazz studies at DePaul University. Immersed in the city's vibrant music culture, she steadily built a presence as both a band leader and side person, culminating in her selection for the 2024 Chicago Music Scene Fellowship. It's a great story. Enjoy this interview.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting into Figments, the tour, everything else that's going on. So thank you for taking a minute out today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So let's begin. Before we get into the debut album, I want to begin with 6 years ago, this pandemic was changing so much about everything that we were dealing with, especially with musicians. How did you get through that era, and how has it influenced the way that you create and approach music today?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when the pandemic hit, I was a junior, senior in high school, and I had a lot of, you know, summer workshops lined up. I was gonna go out to a Berklee summer program and perform at the Newport Jazz Festival. I was super excited about, had all these gigs going on and stuff, and obviously, like everybody else, all of that got taken away very quickly, so it was very tough. And to not be able to play with other people was tough, but it did kind of force me into some different creative outlets, and that's actually kind of how I got into composing in the first place and what got me to start exploring that. And some of the, there's a couple tunes actually on the record that I wrote around that time, so some of my earlier compositions. Also got me into producing more and into kind of just the other ways that we can create within this idiom that do not rely on live performance necessarily.
The one thing I was thinking during that pandemic era was how many people that are just starting out or thinking about getting into this world that's not lucrative to begin with, mm-hmm. may change course because there's no certainty in the future. Did you ever have that thought, or was it always, I'm just going to rearrange my life because jazz is what I'm going to go for, playing an instrument is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I was looking at colleges at the time and thinking about what I wanted to study, and it definitely wasn't always going to be jazz, and I was definitely still exploring other options and stuff, but at the end of the day, when it came down to it, I couldn't imagine not having playing music be a part of my daily life. And I know you can do that and do other careers too, but I ultimately decided that I wanted to give it a shot and see how it went. And I was applying to schools that had programs for the other things I was interested in as well, so that I could pivot if I decided to do that. But I ended up going to DePaul University in Chicago for my undergrad and majored in jazz there, jazz performance, and I just loved it, and I had to just keep doing it. It became like there was no question that I was gonna keep doing that.
So you're originally from Chicago, correct?
I grew up in Minnesota, actually.
Okay, all right, so you're from Minnesota. So take me back to your beginnings. How did the horn, how did jazz, how did music, how did all of this get interwoven into your existence and become your career today?
Yeah, I was always interested in music from a young age, you know, like as a toddler, making up songs, banging on pots and pans, singing, whatever. So it was definitely always a part of my existence. And my parents put me in piano lessons in, you know, kindergarten for a couple years. I wanted to play the guitar, so I took a couple years of guitar lessons. And in like third grade or so, we had to do a biography project, and I picked Ella Fitzgerald because we had the same first name. I didn't know a whole lot about her. It was purely based on the first name. I am partially named after her, but I didn't know much about it. And so I was listening to her, and I just fell in love with her voice. And that got me kind of branched off into listening to more jazz, and I just fell in love with it from the beginning. And so then I started playing percussion, actually, in, like, fifth grade band, and I played drum set in my middle school jazz band, but I was always looking over at the trumpet section, and I thought it would be so fun to get to play the melody and stuff, and I always wanted to try trumpet, so I picked it up towards the end of middle school and just started kind of teaching myself a little bit, and it came really naturally, and it just felt right, and so I kind of switched to trumpet in high school, and really started pursuing jazz more in high school. I was lucky to come up in, you know, the Twin Cities jazz scene has a lot going on, especially for young musicians, so I was in every youth honors jazz ensemble I could be in the Twin Cities area, and that was huge for my upbringing for sure. I was also really lucky that kind of one of my neighbors was Prince's longtime lead trumpet player, so I was able to study privately with him in high school for very affordable rate, and yeah, I just kind of lucked out on a lot of fronts with that, but yeah, trumpet just felt right, came really naturally, and I fell in love with jazz as soon as I heard it, so.
So do you remember the first live jazz show that you saw that blew you away, that galvanized this idea that you would get on stage one day?
I can remember definitely some key ones. I think one that was really big for me was I was really into Kamasi Washington in high school, and one of his concerts was the first kind of major live jazz performance that I saw. And again, and you know, he's jazz is kind of a broad category, right? So he's on one end of the spectrum for sure. But I just remember, you know, that being one of the first performances where it was like, wow, this music can be so much more than just the sound itself. And, you know, he really brings in kind of like a spiritual element to it and kind of makes it more of a emotional experience for the listener, I think, compared to, you know, just the local stuff I had seen before. And that was definitely really huge for me, and I remember that being very transformative, yeah.
So what about players and albums that you were listening to that eventually helped you find your voice on the instrument?
The first trumpeter that I really latched onto was Chet Baker, and I've probably, even to this day, probably transcribed more of his solos than any other trumpeter. I would say Miles is a close second to that. Those two were kind of my early inspirations, I would say, for sure, and definitely influenced my sound. I had a little Art Farmer phase for a little bit, and definitely Lee Morgan and Clifford Brown as well. And then kind of moving forward in time a little bit, Roy Hargrove is a huge influence for me. I feel like my sound is maybe more similar to his than any other trumpeter. And I'm also a huge fan of some contemporary players like Marquise Hill and Theo Croker, Ambrose, Sean Jones, Inger Jensen, you know.
So Figments came out on March 20th. It's your initial debut album, your shout out into the jazz world.
Yes.
When did you decide that you were going to put this album out? And what was kind of the overarching vision of what you were going to embody for your initial project?
Yeah. So I kind of started thinking about this project when I was nearing the end of my undergraduate studies at DePaul. And I had been living in Chicago for 4 years at that point, and I had gotten to collaborate with a lot of incredible musicians there. And I wanted to kind of encapsulate that chapter in my education and my playing, and I think that records are such a beautiful way to kind of serve as landmarks in your development, to be able to encapsulate a certain period of your playing and have that then to look back on in the coming years and be able to see that growth and see where you were at a particular point in time in a particular place. And so I had been thinking about it. I had some friends who are in the recording industry. I was going to try to do it on the cheap, you know, get the friend discount type situation. And I was lucky enough to, I applied for a grant in Chicago, the Chicago Music Scene Fellowship, and I was lucky enough to win that. And that opened up a lot of funding, and which opened up a lot of opportunities to kind of be a little bit more professional with the recording and, you know, be able to pay the musicians in my band and everything, and invest a little bit more into the project, which I think was really good for it. And, you know, I've been sitting on all of these original compositions. Like I said, I started composing around COVID and in high school, and I really wanted to finally get them recorded into a tangible product for my sake. And so, yeah, I was really excited to get to bring together the musicians that I've been working with and collaborating with at DePaul and beyond in the Chicago area, and get to kind of create this project that would encapsulate this period of my playing.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, as you have this dream of being a musician, what age, when did you know that you were going to pursue music full time?
Well, in elementary school, if you asked me what my, like, what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have said a dog sledding rock star. That's what I called it. And yeah. I was playing guitar at the time, and I had this vision that I don't really know why dog sledding came into it, but I was going to dog sled from venue to venue in northern Canada, Alaska area, where there would be snow enough for that, and be a rock star. That was my dream at the time, at a very young age. Then over time, that shifted to more realistic careers around later elementary school, middle school. And I don't think I really seriously considered music as a career until later in high school. I always loved doing it. I was playing in every single honors ensemble I could, all state, everything. But, you know, it was always presented to me as something that's not super economically viable. And so it wasn't until, like, later in high school when I really started looking at colleges that I was like, maybe I should give this a shot. And I was lucky to have some mentors that really encouraged me to do that and pushed me to do that and kind of presented some of the options for how you can make it economically viable. And turns out they were right, and it's working out pretty well for me, so.
So let me ask you this. As you're dreaming about this career of getting into music, there's stages that you dream about playing on. What was the first stage that you played on so far that made you think, wow, I'm here, I've arrived, I'm on this stage? And what is the ultimate stage that you want to play on at some point in the near to not so near future?
That's a good question. I think it was cool to play on the Twin Cities Jazz Fest main stage a couple years ago, which was, you know, I'd been to that festival growing up, so getting to kind of go from being a young person in the audience and seeing some of my heroes perform on that stage to performing on that stage myself was cool. A couple years ago, I toured internationally with the Glenn Miller Orchestra, which was very fun, and got to play some really big concert halls, which was cool. And yeah, I think, honestly, I don't really think about it like dream venue to perform at. I kind of just like to go where the music takes me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try to be ambitious, but I don't like to kind of, it's not about that for me. It's about creating and collaborating and, you know, whether I'm playing at a little rinky-dink venue for an audience of three people, or I'm playing one of these huge concert halls for thousands of people, I want to create an experience that is going to help me connect emotionally with the listener and with the audience and make that a meaningful experience for them.
So the one thing that's going on in America right now is there's all kinds of stressors. We're in war, immigration, there's a lot of things that are going on. And historically speaking, artists and musicians have represented a glue to hold society together, to hold the collective community together, to feel as though we're not drifting out to sea and that we feel connected. But more ever present, the idea of live music is giving people some level of comfort and to get away from the headlines. As an artist, as a musician, are you thinking about those things as you create music and present it to people today?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that music has a really unique cathartic power to be sometimes a point of solace, a point of comfort, a place of maybe distraction to a certain degree of what is going on, or a place of refuge, perhaps. But also to challenge us emotionally, to help us envision the future that we want, to help us feel our sadness and feel our sorrow and our despair and our anger, and help us be in those emotions when we need to be. So yeah, I think that music is always gonna be there regardless of what's going on. It's always going to be there for us to come back to, and really, it's a beautiful way for me, at least, to serve the community and to serve everyone who needs that in their lives.
So, as your idea of sledding gig to gig as a rock star evolved to eventually getting to where you're at in your career right now, you obviously had this idea and this dream of being a musician, waking up every day and creating music. What has been the difference between the dream of what you thought your career was going to be like and actually living it every day right now?
Well, I am not dog sledding from venue to venue, as you might you might guess. I am more often driving or flying. But I think the difference really is that it's a lot... it's kind of easier in some ways than I thought it would be. I think, you know, at that high school age, people are generally discouraging you from pursuing a career in the arts, and you're generally getting a lot of messaging that you can't make money doing this, it's not a viable career, you gotta have a backup option, or you gotta do something else as your main kind of breadwinning source, and maybe music or arts or whatever can be on the side. But I think, you know, if I could give some advice to myself as a high schooler, or when I get to go into high schools and give master classes and workshops, I always tell them, like, there's a lot more opportunities and venues to make this a lucrative career than you might think. And it's, performing is great, and I do a ton of performing, and that is awesome, but that's not the only way that you can make money. And you know, teaching, I do a lot of teaching. I love to teach and give back through that way, and help young musicians develop a lasting relationship with the music. And there's so many other little kind of niches in the music industry that you can pursue. And so I think it's definitely more, perhaps more multifaceted than I thought it would be growing up. You know, you kind of imagine the musician lifestyle to just be like performing and that's it. But, you know, I perform, I teach, I compose, I produce, I record, I write a lot. And there's so many other ways that you can kind of diversify your income within the music, for sure.
Yeah. So what do you like the best about waking up every day being a musician? What do you look forward to? What do you love the most about it?
I love that I get to create every day. And, you know, I love, at this point, I'm doing a lot of teaching, and I teach pretty much every day. And I love that I get to still be learning myself and still be practicing every day and getting better as a musician myself, while also teaching others and then learning from them in turn. And it's kind of this beautiful kind of symbiotic relationship and this like educational ecosystem that we have within the jazz community, that we're all getting to collaborate together and learn from each other and grow together. So
what are you hoping the listener gets from this debut album? It's a big deal. It's your initial shout out into the community, into the world. What are you hoping they get from it?
Yeah, I mean, on a simple level, I just want to kind of introduce myself to everyone and let them get a taste for my playing, but more so for my compositional voice. And of course, hear all the other incredible musicians on the record that we got to work with. But on a deeper level, this project for me is kind of about exploring themes of growth and coming of age, and each piece on the record has its own kind of meaning and its own kind of idea for what I was hoping to inspire the listener to feel or to evoke in the listener. But overall, kind of having the listener reflect on their own growth over the years, their own coming of age experience, what there's certain ideas that I like to call back to, bringing back from our childhood, certain like elements of wonder and awe and creativity that we have as children that start to get blocked out by the stressors of adult life. So bringing back some of that kind of childlike joy into our lives.
So at the end of the day, why do you love this art form we call jazz?
Well, there's so many reasons. I think a lot of that we've touched on in this interview. The collaborative element of it, that it's not just one person sitting down and creating, although you can do that, but it's this, we get to feed off of each other and we get to create together, and I think that is a beautiful way to create community, which is something that we need more than ever in these times. And the cathartic ability of music to help us connect with the listeners and the audience and create a meaningful experience for those who listen to our music. And the power of music on a larger scale in terms of social justice and moving our society forward towards the future that we want to see. And I think it all really just comes back to this community and creating community and getting to participate in this beautiful jazz community. I just love it.
Speaking of community, one of the things that's so vibrant about the jazz community is that there has always been the spirit of the elders teaching younger players, keeping this art form very alive and very vibrant. Unfortunately, today we are absorbing day one of realizing that saxophone colossus has proverbially left the building. And in that sadness, from my end of the microphone, I look at just that's how life works. You have players that are going to come up that are going to eventually be a part of this pantheon, and we just hit the end of our life when we move on. He was 95. He had a wonderful stretch. He's forever going to be one of the greatest Mount Rushmore faces on the pantheon of jazz. So my question to you is this: what has Sonny, what did he teach you from afar about getting into this world of jazz?
Yeah, I mean, so much, obviously. He's such a huge influence on this music. I think he's, for me, listening to him was one of my first really great examples of how to be really melodic with your improvisation, and the phrasing and the space that he uses. And I think that, you know, he keeps things simple sometimes with his improvisation, which is something that is ironically hard to do sometimes as a musician. You know, we want to just spit out as much language as we can and cram it all into our solo and try to be impressive and intellectual. But he's a really great reminder of bringing it back to the melodic roots of the music and bringing it back to a place maybe a little bit out of our head and more towards our heart. And I've always loved that about his playing, and of course his compositions as well. I mean, what a collection of what a prolific composer, really, to be a part of the jazz idiom. And we'll always be playing his tunes for generations to come. So he lives on for sure.
So let me ask you this: if you could get into a time machine and go back in time and see one jazz show, where are you going to go? Who are you going to see?
Oh,
yeah.
That is tough.
I know.
I think, I feel like I have to say Ella Fitzgerald.
Okay.
Because she's who got me into this music. She's my namesake. I feel like she was such a strong, powerful woman in this music. And, you know, even though it's not my instrument necessarily, I think that there's so much to be learned from her, you know, brilliant scatting, improvisation, and I love listening to her live records, and I think it would be so cool to get to experience that in person and be in the room with her.
So mine is hers too, and it would be the first night at the Apollo. When she comes out as this little kid, and everybody's like, whoa, because that's the lion's den of all lion's dens.
Yeah.
So that would be amazing. So if anybody wants to catch you live, you were just talking about doing a tour swing. We're in the warm months firmly now. You have a debut album that's out. How can people pick up a copy, catch you live? Any of the good business, where do they go?
Yeah. So the album is available on all streaming services. If you want to purchase it as a physical CD, you can do that through Shifting Paradigm Records, the label. It's also on Bandcamp if you'd like to purchase it there digitally. As far as performances, I'm playing all over all the time. You can check out my calendar on my website for all the dates that I have coming up. You can also check out my email newsletter for reminders of everything. My Instagram is at ella.grace.music, and my Facebook is Ella Grace. I have links on those pages to the other things that I mentioned. So if you check out my Instagram or my Facebook page, you'll be able to find all the other stuff. I think next big show I have coming up is the Twin Cities Jazz Festival in June 20th. I'm doing a lot of teaching this summer as well. For any young people who may be listening, I'll be teaching at the Shell Lakes Arts Jazz Camp in June. I'll be teaching at the University of North Texas Jazz Camp in July, and then at Birch Creek Jazz Camp at the end of July, beginning of August. Okay. So, and I also offer private lessons anytime, anywhere on Zoom if you are not in the same area as me for an in-person lesson. So, yeah.
Okay, so I have to know, being taught by Prince's trumpet player, what was one of the coolest stories he told you about being around him or being on tour or being next to that level of talent?
Oh my gosh. Man, he had so many great stories for sure. I feel like what really struck me the most was around Prince's passing and kind of him talking about doing the tribute shows and stuff and like the community that was there for those, and you know, being back in the band around that time and stuff was really impactful.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I will make sure to put all these links in the show notes. Ella, thank you for taking a minute out today. Best of luck on the album, your career. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in Chicago, the Twin Cities, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Ella for her time and story. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube, and for everything Neon Jazz, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.